This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, many nurses who work bedside at hospitals say they are burning out. Turnover is high. We'll talk about why. And later, we'll sit down with Sonia Manzano. She portrayed Maria for many years on Sesame Street and is now the creator of a new PBS children's series called Alma's Way. But to start, New Jersey Governor Murphy is looking to become the first Democratic governor to win re-election in the Garden State since the late 1970s. And according to recent polls, Murphy has a fair chance of doing so. He's ahead of his Republican opponent, former Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli, by about 9 percentage points at the moment. Cittarelli is hoping to narrow that gap following tomorrow night's second and final debate. The first meeting between Murphy and Cittarelli a few weeks ago was heated, to say the least, as the two argued over COVID policy, taxes, abortion, LGBTQ rights, and more. The candidates for lieutenant governor also have debated, though the tone was less fiery. The New Jersey governor's race is being watched closely by observers, and we thought we'd touch base with Ashley Koenig ahead of Tuesday's debate. Koenig is director of the Center for Public Interest Polling at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University. Hello, Ashley. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So you say this is Phil Murphy's election to lose. Still he has to do what hasn't been done in 44 years, which is to say be reelected as a Democrat to the governor's office. Ashley, his lead seems to have been shrinking somewhat in recent weeks. Should the Murphy campaign be concerned, do you think?
You know, I think politicians, when it comes to the polls, especially approaching election day, they always want to be the underdog. They always want to paint themselves as the underdog for fundraising and for getting the vote out among their party bases and among new voters as well. So I think what we see here, though, is, you know, maybe he technically has history against him. Maybe he has the way in which New Jersey has recently voted for the opposing party after a presidential against him. But I think the facts on the table are Murphy, by far and away, has very high grades for the number one issue on New Jersey voters' minds, the pandemic. And that's something that really seems to be sticking strongly with him. And he still has a very sizable gap, not to mention almost 2-to-1 Democrats outnumbering Republicans in registration and independent voters leaning more Democratic. So these are all favorable things on his side.
Okay, we'll get into that some more in just a moment. But first, let's take a quick look back at the first debate, which was, you know, sometimes angry and heated, and the crowd was at times raucous. Did it seem to you, Ashley, as if the focus was more on national matters in the first debate, those that can affect perhaps any state, than those unique to New Jersey?
Yeah, you know, at times I almost felt like this debate could have taken place in any other state. You know, New Jersey voters, putting aside the pandemic, the perennial issue for New Jersey voters is about taxes and the local bread and butter issues. We have plenty to talk about in New Jersey, but really we saw a display of national issues on the table, from climate change and abortion to gun control, and of course the pandemic, which touches everybody.
And speaking again of COVID, Cittarelli has said Murphy is responsible for the thousands of deaths in nursing and veterans' homes. Has this impacted Murphy negatively in polls addressing his administration's handling of the pandemic? I mean, in general, you said earlier that Murphy has come out pretty well on this issue, but is Cittarelli scoring any points here with the nursing home issue?
You know, by polling, it doesn't seem like he is. While that may be a worthy point to bring up for a challenger, I mean, we have just seen Murphy's numbers, specifically on the job he's doing with the pandemic, still remain quite high. So, you know, almost like we saw with former Governor Christie after Hurricane Sandy, this is one of those health crises, these crises that arise that no one sees, that is really propelling Governor Murphy. And you know, sometimes we talk about this as a rally around the flag effect, but it's certainly helping him in his general approval and favorability.
Governor Murphy has tried to connect Jack Cittarelli with former President Trump and called some of Cittarelli's positions extreme. Jack Cittarelli's relationship with Trump hasn't necessarily been an easy alliance, has it?
No, it hasn't. He's been doing quite a delicate dance throughout the campaign, whether he wants to embrace him or not. And the fact is, Republicans, you know, his party base see it as a good thing. Obviously, those who are not Republican in the state see it as a bad thing. But it's not necessarily making a huge impact on the campaign itself, but it certainly doesn't help with Cittarelli not necessarily taking a side, especially when he is embracing a lot of those moderate stances, his own moderate career, that of his prospective lieutenant governor candidate. Yeah. You know, for him, it would be wiser to embrace that kind of moderate Republicanism we've seen in the past for Whitman and Christie to their victories.
Yeah. And yet Murphy went after him in the first debate for his speaking role at a Stop the Steal rally after the 2020 presidential election. What did Chitterelli have to say about that?
You know, Chitterelli, again, is kind of denying that he knew it was a Stop the Steal rally. So things like that for both candidates become hard to swallow. They definitely threw some punches at each other that were valid points.
Yeah. There were some surprising revelations from Murphy and Chitterelli in debate number one. What were they, Ashley?
For Murphy, he said no new taxes in a second term. And as a New Jerseyan myself, I'm sure any New Jerseyan would rejoice hearing that. You know, we'll see if that remains to be so, especially, you know, from what we've seen. And of course, like I said, that being the number one issue for Chitterelli, there was some support for driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. You know, and in general, he actually did also come out and say he supported the testing mandate that Murphy has now put on teachers across the state, although he was very adamant about supporting the testing, not so much the vaccine part.
The COVID testing, sure. Okay, so the candidates for lieutenant governor debated last week. Incumbent Sheila Oliver is a former state assembly speaker and the first Black woman to hold that post. A Republican Diane Allen, a former New Jersey state senator and Philly news anchor. Again, Ashley Koenig, the tone was notably more civil, and they actually addressed some, you know, focused more, I guess, on Jersey-centric issues, correct?
They did, very much so, especially Alan had mentioned, you know, motor vehicles, which of course is another top concern among New Jerseyans, also showing a very moderate side, which she's also been known for throughout her career, you know, saying she supports vaccines, but not the mandate. She supports a right to choose, but not expansion through the Reproductive Freedom Act. So kind of, again, playing that line, I'm assuming, in order for the Chitterelli campaign to court more voters.
In your opinion, did either candidate score points on any of the big topics?
You know, I think what we see at the presidential level is debates really don't make a whole lot of difference. They're kind of a showing of what's going on. And we certainly know that these second tier debates, whether a lieutenant governor or a vice president, especially don't have that much more of an impact. They were perhaps more substantive and certainly more civil than the gubernatorial debate. But, you know, we're weeks away from an election when most have probably already made up their minds, especially using partisan cues and voting down partisan lines or intending to vote down partisan lines.
Yeah, let's go back to the gubernatorial candidates. Jack Chitterelli is going after Phil Murphy, incumbent Governor Murphy, on women's issues. You know, Sheila Oliver had mentioned in the lieutenant governor's debate that Murphy, you know, more than half of his cabinet is comprised of women. But the, you know, Chitterelli keeps bringing up the story of Katie Brennan, who was an official in the Murphy administration and who said she got no response from the administration when she reported, you know, she said she had been raped while she was volunteering for Murphy's campaign by another staff member. Do you think this story might come back to haunt Phil Murphy?
Well, the Chitterelli campaign is certainly trying to make it come back to haunt him. And Alan mentioned that as well. To show that Murphy was anti-women. You know, I think this could have been a potentially much more damaging story if not for the pandemic, and especially then the high ratings Murphy has on the pandemic and approval for the steps he has taken during the pandemic. This really colored a lot of his first term pre-pandemic. Yeah. And now, unfortunately, you know, this kind of issue has been put to the side a little bit. Although that being said, Katie Brennan has expressed that she, you know, is not happy about Chitterelli's campaign using her in ads and continually using her as kind of a you know, issue point against Murphy with all of this. So again, you know, both of these campaigns are trying to paint the other as more anti-woman.
New Jersey is widely viewed as a blue state, but you say the reality is different.
You know, I think we're always painted as blue Jersey, or at least in recent decades, but really we're much more purple. I mean, just look at the election of some past governors. If we're talking about Governor Whitman and Governor Christie, you know, I think especially we have some of the most affluent counties in the country. We have some very deep pockets of red and very deep pockets of blue. So I think the picture is a lot more purple when we look at it, you know, and we've seen that after we've seen Democratic presidents get elected. We see that our governor has been Republican sometimes. And so, you know, it paints an interesting picture for Murphy, although the pandemic kind of throws that entire playbook out the window.
Yeah. Well, Christine Todd Whitman and Chris Christie were two-term Republican governors. What was the key to their success in getting elected and reelected, in your opinion?
So, New Jerseyans, New Jersey voters are, you know, I like to say that they're kind of two different type of ideological strains. They're fiscally more conservative, and they're socially a little more liberal, you know, to the left of center on social issues, to the right of center on fiscal issues. And so I think that brand of moderate Republicanism really bodes well for past candidates like Christie and like Whitman. That's what they made their mark on. That's what they were able to win on and, you know, obtain 2 terms. And I think Chitterelli at time is trying to do that and trying to bring up the common sense pocketbook issues, but then at other times trying to make sure he has a party base, which frankly, just by the numbers alone, won't win him the election.
Yeah. Well, you referenced earlier in the conversation New Jersey's independent voters. Do they have the potential to play spoiler in any election?
You know, that's a good question. And actually, for New Jersey, the numbers are shrinking among those who are registered as something else other than Republican or Democrat. In recent years, we've seen that number drop by double digits. But, you know, we do say, especially for the Republican Party within New Jersey, the Republican Party needs independent voters. It's simply a numbers game. The Democrats are outnumbering Republicans 2 to 1. So obviously, extra votes have to come from somewhere. So independents do play a key role. We saw them play a very key role in Christie's reelection after Hurricane Sandy. And of course, you know, this would be a voting block that you'd want to court. Chitterelli's campaign has been saying that he's hoping to court voters that Republicans have never courted before. But I guess that remains to be seen on election day.
President Biden's approval ratings have tumbled recently. One poll last week put approval at about 38% on issues including Afghanistan, the economy, immigration. Ashley, might this negatively affect Phil Murphy?
You know, we have not seen in polling that Trump is necessarily affecting the campaign to a big degree. You know, again, I don't think we'll see Biden affecting to a big degree, although both candidates for lieutenant governor for different reasons said that they would love to see Biden for various reasons. But of course, all across the state in all the elections, you know, the typical names of Trump and Biden and Pelosi will all get pulled out and dragged out in attack ads.
And as for tomorrow night, can we expect to hear more about New Jersey issues? What do you think they'll be talking about?
One would hope, and that's been the real big desire over the past week or so. So I would assume the candidates would want to shift to something like that. But again, the pandemic is all-consuming, and while it touches these localized issues, these statewide issues, it's really hard to avoid these big national issues when politics has become so nationalized and so hyper-partisan nowadays.
All right, remains to be seen. Ashley Koenig, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ashley is assistant professor and director of the Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling at Rutgers University. Up next on the regional roundup, we speak with Maureen May, who heads the Pennsylvania Association of Staff Nurses and Allied Professionals. We're going to be talking about the shortage of hospital nurses and the reform that her organization is pushing for, and also what it's like to be in her position as a full-time nurse at Temple University Hospital. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. There has long been a shortage of nurses working bedside in hospitals, but the pandemic has turned the shortage into what many call a full-blown crisis. Hospital nurses speak of burnout and PTSD, of being asked to care for more patients than is considered to be safe. Some, just out of school, say they're being asked to handle assignments they're not yet ready for. Others contend that management wants them to do more with less. And in addition, violence against healthcare workers is on the rise. Consequently, turnover among bedside nurses at hospitals is concerningly high. And nurses at a number of local hospitals have either threatened to strike or have walked off the job in recent months and years. In Pennsylvania, a proposal to establish nurse-patient ratios is before the legislature, but it is receiving pushback from hospital organizations, which say it could actually exacerbate the problem. Our guest is Maureen May, president of the Pennsylvania Association of Staff Nurses and Allied Professionals, or PASNAP. She is also a full-time nurse at Temple University Hospital's Infant Intensive Care Unit. Maureen, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Well, thank you, Mary. I appreciate you having me on the show today.
And we'd like to bring our listeners into the conversation as well. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. Send an email to radiotimes at whyy.org, or you can also tweet us at whyyradiotimes. So, Maureen, before we get to the Patient Safety Act, let's begin by talking a bit about the job of the direct care nurse. They really are on the front line of healthcare for the person who's hospitalized, correct?
Absolutely. We are always on the front line. Just a small statistic here is that 28 million nurses globally, 60% of them are in the healthcare workforce, and 90% of those nurses deliver primary healthcare, and that's internationally. So we are a very large group of people that provide a very significant service.
The pandemic has been extraordinarily stressful, and at the same time, it's also underscored the chronic understaffing of nurses providing direct care at bedside. Shortages have been around for years. Why is that, Maureen?
It has to do with the conditions. I have been through at least three, as they call them, RN shortages. I have to highlight the fact, though, that we're not short the number of licensed registered nurses. They have plenty of registered nurses that could fill the shoes of direct caregivers in hospitals and healthcare workplaces, only that the problem is that the conditions prevent nurses from working at the bedside or working in healthcare. So there is not a shortage of licensed registered nurses. There is a shortage of nurses that are willing to work at the bedside.
Well, let's talk about some of the conditions. According to recent published reports, nurses and other staff at hospitals routinely face or can face physical and verbal abuse from the people they're trying to help. What's at play here?
That's for years. I've been a nurse, I have to point out, for 37 years. And when we were first, when I was first a nurse, it became part of the fabric of what you are to put up with when you're a nurse, is that workplace violence was not interpreted back then as what it is today. However, our environments and our societies have gotten more violent. Nurses have had confidence within themselves to stand up to the workplace violence issues, and they're escalating. So there's a lot of fear. The pandemic has exacerbated that. Families are frightened. Family members are frightened. You have patients that are frustrated and angry because say they're not receiving their pain medication on time, or that they're waiting so long that they fall, which is one of the never events that happen in a hospital, is that a patient should really not fall. And, you know, when a nurse can only be in one place at one time. So when you lack the resources or people, I should call it human resource, to take care of patients, and patients are affected by that. They become angry, upset, and again, we also have a more violent society, as well as increasing mental illnesses that play into this workplace violence.
So what do the nurses face? What are some of the anecdotes you've heard?
Plenty. I mean, I have a good friend that opened a door and got punched in the eye and had a detached retina, only because they were going to discharge a patient who didn't want to be discharged. So these are nurses are pushed up against the wall, whether the patient is mentally challenged or not. These are, we're regularly pinched, spit at, verbally abused. This occurs regularly, and that's, what we have become used to. And more so in the emergency rooms. You see a lot more in the emergency rooms, but I worked the weekend, this past weekend. I'm a direct care registered nurse full-time, and we hear this code gray overhead, and the first thing we think about is, I wonder which nurse is getting hurt now on what floor. So, yes, we overhear those code grays, and, they happen very frequently.
So, and code gray means a nurse is being assaulted.
Either it's a patient to patient and the nurse has to, or a family member, it means that there's an assault occurring. There's a workplace violence event. and that we're summoning help. So we need help at that point. So it's an alert to security to please come to the area where the assault is occurring.
Okay. I'm going to get to nurse-patient ratios in just a moment. But first, PASNAP is planning to meet with Philadelphia DA Larry Krasner this week. What will you ask of him, Maureen?
Well, we're going to need help. We need a liaison, you know, with workplace violence. Again, nurses, you know, they don't actually work in law, and they want to know what we can do in collaboration with our facilities in Philadelphia to keep a record of the workplace violence incidents, what is a workplace violence incident, and have a liaison. We did have a liaison in Delaware County, and we would like to have a liaison in Philadelphia to give us assistance because we are direct caregiver nurses, and we need that help with the Krasner's office to help us navigate through this issue that we have and are faced with regularly.
So let's talk about nurse-patient ratios. What is an ideal ratio, if you would, and what are we seeing in reality?
Well, depending on what floor you work in, obviously, that's defined in our Patient Safety Act, which I will mention is House Bill 106 and Senate Bill 240. So those numbers are defined. So, for instance, I will talk about a med-surg because there's clear evidence that, obviously, that the less patients that you have to care for, the better care they will receive, which is equals outcomes and comorbidities and mortality. So on a med-surg floor, it's clearly stated that you should have a four patients per nurse, and for each patient above that number, the risk for a surgical patient dying increases by 7%, which has been clearly identified for at least 10 years. That study's been out. So that's just an example. So if you have a fifth or sixth patient on the floor, which many do, then obviously you've increased. If you have two additional patients, those two additional patients or those patients within your care have a 14% greater risk of mortality.
Mm. And so when the ratio is higher than it should be, you spoke to producer Paige Mary Bessler of the moral injury many nurses suffer. What is the moral injury you are speaking of?
The moral injury is that, you know, you go into nursing to take care of people. I have to say, 37 years as a nurse, I love being a nurse. So when I can't provide the care and the proper care, and I have a negative outcome or there's mortality that faces us because we can't do what we were going to do when we get into this profession, is that we face that moral dilemma. We come home from work wondering, did I do harm? Did I do everything right? Is my patient going to be safe? Did I miss something? So, you know, we are human beings. There's only so much we can do, and we need the resources to take care of people. That's why the moral injury is there. And when we're not, you know, and we believe that this is the for-profit system that's a threat to us, is that, you know, we would like that corrected and to invest more in nursing and the conditions at the bedside because the outcomes are better. It's clearly documented. There's plenty of empirical data around great outcomes with great nursing ratios.
Are there legal ramifications for the nurse if a patient is injured?
There are legal ramifications. Unfortunately, working in a hospital, I am able to escalate and put the onus on the, or should I say the liability on the hospitals, because I will report when there is inadequate staffing. And so it'll be a shared responsibility when there is a liability or a fall or an infection. And there are standards around infections, falls, and those types of injuries.
Maureen, vaccine mandates have caused some hospital staff to leave. In Philly, staff at hospitals must receive at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine by October 15th, which I think is this Friday. Where does PASNAP land on this issue?
PASNAP will encourage people to get their vaccines. We also understand that we should not be threatened with our job to work. So, you know, we look at it both ways. There is, you know, people do want to continue to work. And one of the things that challenges me as a nurse is the fact that if you've already had COVID and you have antibodies that well exceed your immune system and that you're immune to it, because we do have healthcare workers and nurses that have the COVID and have high numbers of antibodies. They should not be, you know, it's the position of our union that why are we vaccinating somebody, giving them a vaccination if they already have the antibodies and the immunity?
So you say there should be options.
Absolutely.
Options for testing for antibodies and et cetera.
Oh, sure.
Are vaccine mandates exacerbating staffing shortages?
They are. They are. In fact, I just had a full-time nurse leave my unit who's been with us for 25 years.
Okay.
So, yes, they are leaving the system because of the vaccine mandate.
Comment from Kate, we spend trillions of dollars on war. Why don't we spend a lot more of it on nurses? More money.
Exactly.
They are the people that save everybody. I didn't think you were going to disagree with that one, Maureen.
Yes, you need to invest in nursing and nursing care. We're all going to be a patient one day, and I sure do hope that my nurse has an adequate ratio in order to provide care to me and my family member, and I would love to have that the same, to be able to do what I do at the bedside every day.
All right, so let's talk about legislation, which is pending before, I believe, both houses of the General Assembly in Pennsylvania, the Patient Safety Act. What would it do?
Well, it would give us a minimal nurse-to-patient ratio and also takes into acuity. It would also provide a whistleblower opportunities for nurses to be able to escalate and whistleblow and put their hospitals on notice. It will also, ultimately, what will this do? This will make better working conditions. It will return nurses to the bedside. It will make outcomes better for patients and of Pennsylvania. I mean, that's really the answer.
Well,
there's a lot of challenge around that, especially from our hospital associations. There's
well, I was going to say we did get a statement from the Hospital and Health System Association of Pennsylvania, which says in part, mandating nurse-to-patient ratios in hospitals will not solve the challenges hospitals are facing filling open nursing positions, and in fact could make an already dire situation worse. I'm going to read a little bit more of this here. There's a shortage of nurses all across our state and country. Mandatory ratios will not suddenly produce more nurses to solve this problem, and there's insufficient evidence that they work. Only one state in the nation has such ratios, and the result has been increased emergency department wait times, reductions in other programs and services, cutbacks to non-nursing staff, and higher costs. So one concern, Maureen, seems to be, you know, if you mandate nurse-patient ratios, there will be a domino effect negatively affecting other hospital services, and that some hospitals might even shut down. What are your thoughts here?
My thoughts are we can look to California, and the California hospital did not shut down. In fact, what happened was we had an increase of nurses returning to the bedside, and that's what I said in the beginning of the program is we don't have a shortage of licensed registered nurses. We have a shortage of those nurses that are willing to come back to the bedside and work it with the conditions that we have. And right now, there's plenty of incentives for nurses to come back, and the nurses are not jumping into those incentives. So there's licensed personnel that would come back to the bedside had they the proper ratios, had they the proper conditions, and walked out of their job at the end of the day believing that they did the right thing for their patients and that they cared for their patients. We just have to take a look at California, and this is the same thing that was said in California, but I don't see the California hospitals system falling apart.
We've got a question from Ezekiel who says, years ago, I was a psychiatric nurse. We dealt with violence. Are you addressing what happens with nurse assistants, like the violence they face and their own staff issues, or just the nursing staff shortage? And of course, there was the homicide at Jefferson Hospital just, I guess, a week and a half or so ago, in which a nursing assistant was gunned down.
Yes.
So what are your thoughts here, Maureen?
Yes, there's a workplace violence bill in the House, and it's not just for nurses. It's for any healthcare worker. Provides an opportunity for all healthcare workers to be protected. And yes, psych is a highly volatile situation to work in. I understand that, given that Episcopal is right around the corner from us and they are a sister hospital. So this bill, workplace violence bill, would cover all healthcare workers.
Yeah.
And at PASNAP, we have workplace violence is one of our part of our mission and value statement to protect all healthcare workers.
Yeah, and I should say that the person who died at Jefferson was apparently allegedly shot by a coworker. So just to clarify that,
mm-hmm.
Are you hearing from nurses in direct care, Maureen, who are looking to go elsewhere in the field?
Yes, many of our nurses, the turnover rate is 5 years for new nurses. Nurses such as myself that have been around for a while, you know, will stay. But nurses have more opportunity, and many of them would like to leave the bedside. They're looking at informatics or a case management job, a job where they're not in direct care. And so, yes, there is. Also, they go for advanced degrees, et cetera, but some nurses are just leaving completely, whether they're retiring early or looking for a different job outside of healthcare.
Stepping out of the hospital for just a moment, many school nurses say they are completely overwhelmed these days, especially in a large city like Philly. In addition to treating children, they're administering COVID tests and doing contact tracing and a mountain of paperwork. What sort of relief? I don't know if school nurses are covered by the district or under your union, but what sort of relief do you know is in the pipeline for them, if anything?
I'm not aware of anything. At PASNAP, we do not have school nurses. The universities do, and they usually fall within the school system in their districts. But, you know, there's obviously, no matter where you are as a nurse, obviously there is this failure to enact policies that establishes safe care for patients, children, et cetera.
Yeah. We got a listener from Malvern who says, how could you go through any semblance of medical training and then refuse the vaccine?
That is a labor issue for the union, that we make that a personal choice, but we also encourage our healthcare workers and nurses to get vaccinated.
So as a professional, though, Maureen, you feel confident that a nurse who has not been vaccinated but who's had COVID and has antibodies is a healthcare worker who you know, will not pass the virus along to the person she is treating or he is treating?
I do feel confident. And I also want to point out that we were told not to wear masks in the beginning of COVID, and we knew what the right thing was to do. And so, you know, if we're doing, especially within the hospital, I have nurses that worked in the COVID unit from day one till now and have never gotten COVID because they used proper technique and they did what we were trained to do. And, of course, obviously, they hopefully had the proper staffing to make sure that they can get that done.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Maureen May, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Maureen is president of the Pennsylvania Association of Staff Nurses and Allied Professionals. Up next on the Regional Roundup, Sonia Manzano was beloved by generations in the role of Maria on Sesame Street. She's got a new show, which she has. She's launching herself. It's called Alma's Way. We'll hear all about it. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. You're listening to the musical introduction of a brand new animated PBS children's series called Alma's Way, a colorful, cheerful, and thought-provoking show about a young girl of Puerto Rican heritage who lives in the Bronx. It was created by Sonia Manzano, whose portrayal of Maria on Sesame Street is beloved by generations of children and their parents. She played Maria from 1971 until her retirement from the role in 2015. And Manzano also wrote for the show, winning 15 Emmy Awards. She's an author as well and a recipient of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Award. And it is with pleasure we welcome Sonia Manzano to the Regional Roundup for the rest of the hour. So good to have you with us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Let me give the number out. It's 888-477-9499. Listeners can send an email to Radio Times at whyy.org or tweet us at whyy Radio Times. So, Sonia, lots to talk about. Let's begin with Alma's Way. You grew up in the Bronx as a first-generation mainland Puerto Rican. Is it a stretch to say that Alma's experiences are inspired by your own?
Oh, absolutely. Everything Alma does is something that I would have done as a kid, or I would have liked to have done as a kid. Linda Saminsky at PBS Kids asked me to create a show, and she said a Latin family show. And of course, being a New Yorican Puerto Rican, that's what I made them. And I placed them in the South Bronx where I was raised.
So let's talk about some of the characters, her family members, and also her neighbors and friends. They are a diverse group of people. Tell us more.
Yes, they're a diverse group of people that live in the Bronx, and it's a very personal show. The characters are based on people that I knew. There's Alma has a little brother named Junior, as I had a little brother named Junior. There's a character in the show, Alma's cousin is Eddie Mambo. And Eddie Mambo in the animated series has cerebral palsy, and he is a combination of two people in my life. One was my real cousin musician, Eddie Guagua Rivera, and a kid I knew who had polio and loved to dance. So that was the inspiration. Those two people were the inspiration for Eddie Mambo. My family was very musical. This family is very musical. And some of the stories are actually based on things that happened to me.
I've also read that you say Alma's Way is probably one of the few places that people will see Afro-Latino characters on TV.
Yes, I think in an animated series, this might be the first time. I can't be sure about that. I haven't seen everything that's out here for children's television, but that was important to me to illustrate and depict Caribbean Latin people, Caribbean Spanish-speaking people. There's a Cuban character as well. As a matter of fact, Eddie Mambo's father, Uncle Nestor, is Cuban. Of Cuban descent, and he's an actor. He's, you know, sort of like works in Shakespeare in the Park when he can get a job. That's that's his character. And all of the characters are based in reality. They have jobs like that.
And they're drawn with varying skin shades. Is this a significant nuance?
Yes. We were very, very interested in showing many, many skin tones and not only in the people of color, the white people too. I mean, not all white people have the same kind of same skin tone. So we wanted to show that diversity so that we really show the bouquet of humankind on the show. As you know, there's a family from Bangladesh, and we were very careful to how we depicted them. I really wanted Alma to have a round nose and not a perky upturned nose, so she had a little bit more of a Afro vibe to her.
So what sets this series apart are what are called think through moments. What are they and what is the goal?
Yes, it's think through moments, and the mission of the show was left up to me, and I looked around and I saw that a lot of kids are overwhelmed by having to memorize, being tested constantly, and they were turned off to school. And I thought, oh, they're turned off to learning even before they realize how fabulous it is to think and to go into your brain and to be able to figure things out and how exciting that all is. So that's clearly what the show is about. The think through is Alma thinking through something that's happened or thinking through to find a solution to a problem or some jam how to get out of a jam she's gotten herself into. So in every episode, and this is the most important aspect of the show, Alma says, I have to think about this, and a globe appears by her head and we see her thought process. And that's what was the most important thing for me to get across to children. I lived in a very tumultuous neighborhood. My family life was very tumultuous, and I found relief and refuge in my mind. And that's what I want to get across.
Yeah, in your memoir, Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx, you write of witnessing acts of domestic violence. Can a children's show help kids navigate tough situations?
I think so. I think that Sesame Street set out to do that, and it's not by giving them lessons in what to do, overt lessons exactly, but you can give them tools. And one of the tools that we're giving them through Alma's Way is, you know, your ideas are just as valid as anybody else's. The way you see the world is just as valid as anybody else's. And we can't teach them that. We can only tell them that whatever goes on in their heads is valuable.
How do you write for children without talking down to them?
Oh, that's a very good question. And I always say, assume that they have thoughts that they bring to the table. Assume that you can infer something and they can take it the rest of the way. I think that we get overwhelmed when we deal with kids because we think that they don't have their own thoughts and ideas, and they do. That's why parents constantly say to kids, where did you get such an idea to do that? Well, they got it from the way they see the world. Yeah. And so we have to encourage that.
Yeah. In a print interview, Sonia, you said Sesame Street always looked around to see what the needs of kids were at the moment in America. Have the needs changed significantly, do you think, over the last five decades?
Yes, I think so. I think kids are the same, but our expectations of them have just absolutely gone through the roof. I was talking to somebody whose kindergarten kid, age kid, is expected to be in kindergarten through Zoom for 5 hours a day. Parents say things like, I have to get my kid into the Harvard of a preschool. And it's like, what? So we are expecting so much of them these days.
Yeah. And also, too, digital devices have changed the landscape for kids and how they relate to each other, you know, eye contact, how they spend their time.
Yes, of course. I mean, they're getting a lot of information through their devices. And you can't stop that. And you can't say, don't watch, don't play with your device. But television was a device. And Joan Ganz-Cooney thought, yeah, let's use this. Let's figure out how to use this in ways that are helpful. And so probably we can still do some work on that.
Well, one thing I've noticed in a lot of children's animation today is the action often moves really fast, like with lightning speed. And it's struck me that, you know, this might be a little overstimulating, especially to young children. Alma's Way is lively and colorful, but it doesn't feel overwhelming. Were you purposeful in crafting the pace?
Yes, I think that you need a show has to breathe or it's going to be brittle if it goes too fast. And I think the reason it goes too fast is that people are interested in eyes on screen and they think the kids is not paying attention or doesn't like the show if he's not looking at it. Whereas I believe that kids can look away and look under their shoes and, I don't know, stick their finger in their ear while they're absorbing this information.
Yeah.
So we want it to be at a nice pace with some highlights, with some high points.
We've got a tweet from Jonathan who says, you're working with Fred Rogers' company for the show. Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street are kind of like TV cousins. What's it like to work with that group now?
Well, it's very interesting. We were sort of on opposite ends. One was cognitive skills when we started. That was Sesame Street. And Mr. Rogers was social and emotional literacy. And you know, we were perfect together way back then. You know, Mr. Rogers at 3:30 and Sesame Street at 4. And I think this is a great combination. And I have to say that when I started creating the show, I didn't care what the kids thought about. I just wanted to know that they could think. And it was Ellen Dougherty at Fred Rogers Productions who came up with the notion of having, you know, I have to think about this and having a solution out of each problem that's posed.
Is it true you took your animators to the Bronx to see it in person?
Yes, that was another wonderful idea that Fred Rogers Productions had. And I thought, well, why can't they just see it on the internet, you know, pictures and everything, now that we get so much information from the internet. But since they're Canadians, we thought we should go to the Bronx. And the Bronx is vibrant. The Bronx is has interesting architecture because when Robert Moses cut through with the Cross Bronx Expressway, there's highways, you know, in the middle of it, and there's over a river, and there's a train station that runs through it as well. And those were probably negative aspects of the Bronx. But I wanted the animators to see it and sort of make something beautiful out of it.
And so the trip was worth it? They captured the essence?
Oh, absolutely. They got a sense of the murals. They got a sense of how the people dress. It was very important for me to have very Caribbean bodies, that the women have Caribbean bodies, you know, in the show. And they had to sort of, you know, look at all of that stuff. And I think we'll probably bring them again so they could see some more.
So since we can't see this on the radio, describe what you mean by the dress and the Caribbean body, and how much of input do you have in on how these characters are actually drawn in the way you'd like to see them?
Well, I look at every single rendering of the characters, and I wanted mommy to have like your full hips and very curvy, and the characters are based on people that I admire, like Uncle Nestor is based on Raul Julio, who was an actor, great Puerto Rican actor, very tall and thin, so that was him. And I must say though that Tia Gloria is based on the way she looks as Carol Channing, because I wanted a big face with a
and
gap
a big
in her,
smile
and
yeah.
a big smile. Yeah. And I think they came up with a gap in her teeth, which I think is really specific and terrific.
Yeah, Carol had her own look, certainly.
Yeah.
Well, we can't chat without at least talking a bit about the character of Maria. Again, you portrayed her on Sesame Street for over 40 years. What does she mean to you, Sonia?
It was such a wonderful experience for me. I watching television as a kid in the Bronx in the 50s, which I've always loved television as an art form. I never seeing anybody that reflected me or my life, and I wondered what I was going to contribute to a society that was blind to me. I was invisible to them. So when I got to be on Sesame Street and they said, "This is your purpose. We want these kids to have somebody to relate to," I kind of became what I needed to be myself when I was a kid, and that was really gratifying. And I know that I'm not going to be falsely modest. I know I've made an impact because of the letters that I get and the way people treat me. Yeah. But I'm sorry that things are in the United States the way they are. I thought we had solved all the problems of racism on Sesame Street in 1971, but clearly, we haven't. So we the only thing to do is to keep going. And now with Alma's, I mean, there's nothing else to do but proceed. And with Alma's Way, kids will see even a more specific character. This is a New Yorican character in her own life, and an Afro Puerto Rican. And the more specific you are, I learned that from Sesame Street too.
Yeah.
The more specific you are, the better you'll.
Well, we have a tweet from Mike who says he loved watching Maria on Sesame Street. So many happy memories. So thank you for that, Mike.
Thank you.
Was it tough to retire, Maria?
No. And did you catch that you called me Maria?
Oh, did I? He called you Maria.
Oh,
you mean from
I
the
see.
Tweet? Yeah.
No, I'll tell you.
It's easy to do.
Everybody does. No, yeah. No problem at all. I certainly answered to it. No, it really wasn't tough for me to retire. I think the time had come. I'll tell you a funny story. Sometimes some of the celebrities that would come into the show would be fabulous, and I wouldn't know who they were. And so I thought to myself, when you stop recognizing the celebrities that come onto Sesame Street, maybe it's time to create something else.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of wrap up the show here on a point that you kind of brought up in a couple moments ago. And this is the polarization, what's going on in our country. How do we help children through this moment, especially if they might be hearing some of the frustration and anger at home? And how might children's television help with that?
I mean, I think the only way is to not beat them over the head with it. You got to like everyone or anything like that. But I think it's just show them and demonstrate people solving problems together, I think is a good way to go. I volunteered for a while with the Bronx River Alliance, and it connects the poorest neighborhood with the richest neighborhood in America, and we all solved the problem. So there was a lot of different people solving the one problem. I think that's a way to sort of get people to connect.
Yeah, and you get that in Alma's Way. Such a terrific, such a fun show. Thank you so much for joining us, Sonia.
Thank you.
Sonia Mazzano is creator of the new PBS children's show, Alma's Way. Our engineer today is Diana Martinez, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Be well.